Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Pod bless everybody. I'm your host of OPP, Corey Cambridge. And before we get started with this amazing episode, I want to tell you about my other show, Silent Giants. Silent Giants is a podcast that highlights the superstars behind the scenes of popular culture. Ever wondered who made the MTV logo? Did you know the person who wrote Earth, Wind & Fire's hit song September also wrote the theme song for the hit 90s TV show Friends? On Silent Giants, we learn more about these amazing people and dig deep to learn more about their most famous works. Be sure to check out Silent Giants on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Now, let me introduce you to our special guest of OPP.
I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. This is OPP.
God bless everybody and welcome back to another episode of OPP, Other People's Podcast, is America's number one podcast discovery platform that highlights your favorite podcasters and the dope shows they created. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Our special guest this episode is culinary historian Linda Palacio, host of the amazing podcast, A Taste of the Past. On this podcast, Linda takes us on a weekly journey through the history of food. Tune in for interviews with authors, scholars, and culinary experts who discuss food culture from ancient Mesopotamia and Rome to the grazing tables and deli counters of today. In this interview, we're going to learn more about Linda. We chat about her career as a culinary historian. We get her podcaster's picks. And of course, we chat about her dope show, A Taste of the Past. So now, on to my exclusive interview with Linda Palacio. What's up, Linda? How you doing?
Hi, Corey. Thanks for having me here. This is really cool. It's, as I said, it's interesting and also a little intimidating to be on the other end of the mic for a change.
It's a pleasure. You have such good energy.
Well, then, you know, I try to keep it up when it's, you know, something about when you know, the tape, it's not the tape anymore. You said in the old days, when it's rolling, that's sort of like the energy goes on, you know, that little inner voice says, okay, you're on.
Yeah.
You know, ready for my close up.
You've got that like Katie Couric energy.
Oh, okay.
That Meredith Vieira energy.
All right. I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah. So we were hanging out earlier before you hit the play button, right. And you were telling me you're from South Bend,
Indiana. Yeah. Mayor Pete.
So wait, did you go to Notre Dame?
No, I was at another school at the time. My husband went to Notre Dame, however.
Where'd you end up going to school?
Sarah Lawrence College in New York.
In New York, yeah. Is that all girls school?
It used to be. Now it's not. It's co-ed. It went co-ed in the 70s.
Okay.
Late 70s.
What was it like in South Bend?
You know, I didn't know from anything different, so it was just fine. But I traveled early on as a teenager. I had gone on a few student trips to a lot of other countries, and I said, I'm not staying. So anyway, I met my husband. He was from New York, and I went, I'm there.
Wait, how'd that happen? Because you were going to school at Sarah Lawrence, and he was going
I was at Purdue at that time.
Oh, okay. Got it. Boilermaker.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's what's up. You like Drew Brees?
Well, he was way past my time.
Yeah, were you a fan?
Yeah, I guess.
You got to be a fan.
As much as I would.
He
plays football, right?
Do you follow sports?
Yes, I do. One school.
What
Notre
school?
Dame.
Notre Dame. Okay, right. Okay.
Right.
Hey, you guys have won a couple things.
Yeah, it could have been a better season so far, but...
You know, it's okay. You guys have some titles.
Yeah. It's fun, you know. I get into the action, so...
I was doing some research on you because I love your show, and then I was able to do some research on you as well, and you have the most amazing title, a culinary historian.
Right, that's...
That's an amazing job title.
Well, you know, for a long time, there was this division or some on both sides, fine line, a kind of a skewed line between food history and culinary history. Food history being the more scientific, you know, where does the food come from, you know, tracing its background. And culinary history is more about what we ate, when we ate it, how we ate it, sitting down at the table, what was the tablescape like? You know, it sort of encompasses everything about food and cooking and eating, but it's food history as well. So now a lot of the, you know, the scholars used to think they were on the food history side of things, and that, you know, culinary history just wasn't scholarly enough. Now they've come to realize that it does encompass everything from food history to dining and, you know, how people wear foodways, where people got their food and how they prepared it. So that is really, food history wasn't really concerned with how it was prepared. And now that's all sort of, you know, come under the same umbrella.
Tell me the history of how food became a passion of yours in your life.
Ooh, I guess I always liked to eat. That was pretty easy. And I have to say, my mother was a good cook. She was a cook of economic means. I mean, she managed to make a good meal out of whatever she had. And primarily was a single mom for a long time. So, you know, things were tight, but she always put a good meal on the table. So I learned about how to put it together and what it was there. And I enjoyed watching her. And then she actually made me have to cook some meals for my younger sister. But that was all good. That was fine. Then when I got married, my husband and I, 3 days later, got on a boat to Italy. And we lived in Italy for 5 years. Yeah, it was rough.
That sounds terrible. Who would ever want to do that?
And that's where I fell in love with food and food history and culinary history. That's where it all came together for me.
You know what's wild is that growing up, I'm from Virginia, and I didn't have a lot of friends from around the world or, you know, even across the country. So it really wowed me when I moved to New York City and people weren't eating like seafood all the time. Like in Virginia, everyone's eating crabs and fish, and that's just a part of your like daily diet. In South Bend, what were some of like the regional things that were native to the area that made it very, very unique?
You know, I was very young. I lived there until I was 17 and went off to school. So was I paying attention to what was regional? You know, as far as the county fairs, the 4-H fairs, you know, you got the typical carnival food. But, you know, that was the only thing I could remember as a kid. But my mother came from a Polish background. Her parents were both Polish. And my father came from the back hills of Tennessee. So she was trying to cook foods that he liked, and yet she really didn't really know that much of Polish food background. She was sort of had to start cooking. Her mother got ill very young, and she had to start cooking as a young woman. So she just sort of put together whatever she saw her relatives cooking. And I can't tell you what the regional specialties were because I lived within my own family. And
yeah.
That's what I knew. And I didn't really, as you were saying, you didn't have friends from, you know, all over the country, all over the world. I wasn't sure what other people ate for dinner every night. You know, I knew what my family ate, and that was, you know, that was about it.
When you got to Italy, was that when you realized you wanted to study food?
Yes.
Tell me the story of that. Like, how did that come to be?
It was sort of an organic process. It kind of happened naturally because, number one, we had to eat, and I had to get some food, and I had to learn the language and go to the market and buy some food. It's kind of intimidating because you have to understand this was a long time ago. It was in 1968. And to go and buy some meat, you had to go to the local butcher store around the corner, and there were a lot of dead animals hanging from the doorway. So after I would kind of like sneak my way between the bodies, you know, and I would look at something and point and manage to get something. Found out that I got some horse meat that was not exactly fresh. The first time I tried to buy hamburger, because I said, I can make a hamburger. and then, you know, little by little, it all came together. And there were not supermarkets. There were markets. There were small groceries where you could get a little superette here in New York, a little bodega. and you'd get everything, even your wine and oil, if you brought your own bottle to fill it up. It was really an incredible experience at that time. It was, you know, then the changing, a real changing point came about 4 years later. This was in Rome, in the city. So about, I guess about 4 years later, there was a real change and supermarkets opened. Not huge ones, but, you know, but basically supermarkets. And that made life a lot easier for someone who wasn't used to going into the Italian, you know, stores and buying food.
How did you know that you were going to turn your love for food into a career?
I couldn't pinpoint when that happened, really. It was just always there, and that was always my passion. So while I was doing a lot of other things, food and well, food history, the history, and well, art history, history of food, living in Rome, you're surrounded by history, that was always there in the back of my mind. So when we moved back to New York, then I, at that point, I had a family, and I, you know, I was doing the mother thing, and volunteered a lot, and then worked in politics, but I always wanted to do food. So then I joined an organization called the Culinary Historians of New York. I saw a little ad in the New York Times for a program by Karen Hess for the Carolina Rice Kitchen, and she was going to do a presentation on her book. I said, oh my goodness, this is right up my alley. I want to go. And from that was it. I was a member of the Culinary Historians ever since, and still do programming for them. And that led me to really wanting to do more with it. Along came the Food Network. Now, this was before it actually was the Food Network and was up and running, but a friend of mine was working there, and she was all a flutter, like, oh, we'll never be ready in time. I said, what? What are you talking about? And she told me. I went, okay, do they need writers? Do they need content? And she said, yeah, call this number. And next thing you know, I was working at the Food Network.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I was there about 2-3 months before we went on the air, and then we went up on the air, you know, big time in 94. Oh, it took a long time for us to really, 1994, it took a long time for it to really get widespread.
Why is it important for, do you feel like chefs or cooks to learn the history of food and the story of food?
Well, I think it's always important for chefs to know what came before them and where this dish that they're cooking, did they invent it? Or, well, you know, everything is sort of a derivative of something else. And I think it makes them appreciate the food. Just like walking into the butcher shop through the dead animals hanging in the doorway, you got to know where your food comes from. Those animals are not just hanging there by chance. Okay, if you're going to eat meat, you got to know that it's from a dead animal hanging in the doorway, okay? If you're going to cook a particular dish that maybe has been cooked for 2 years or 20 or 100, kind of should know where it came from. I don't think that's not, I don't know if it's actually necessary, but as far as knowing your ingredients,
yeah,
I think it's important. It makes anyone who, the more information a person, I always say, having interviewed a lot of chefs back in the day, the most successful chefs, I felt, and were the intelligent ones who gave it some thought, who had some life experience, who, you know, had a little background to what they were doing.
Mm. For folks who want to get into the culinary historian realm and world, how did they become a member of the Culinary Historians of New York?
Well, there are culinary historian groups all over the country. In New York, you can go to culinaryhistoriansny.org. Number one, we have monthly lectures on a whole variety of topics. And we also give scholarships to people in the field of food history and culinary history. And that is funded by the Julia Child Foundation. They have given us a generous grant.
Wow.
To give scholarships to people.
Now, I don't know anything about culinary school, but do they teach the culinary history at culinary school as well? Or is it mostly about, like, just cooking?
If you're going to cooking school, you're learning to cook.
Okay.
But if you are going into a food studies program, you'll learn more about the history of food. They now have Jacques Pepin and Julia Child actually were the first two to ever start a food studies program per se. I mean, you know, they're in history. You could find things, you know, by studying history, you could find some things out. But at Boston University, they put together a program on food studies. And that's where it all started. Now, just about every major university has some type of food studies program.
Okay. You know what, Linda, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to get to your podcast, A Taste of the Past.
Okay.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And we're back. How'd you first discover the medium of podcasting?
Well, actually, the actual way I came across it was from my son. He was doing, who happens to be a chef as well. He was doing a show on this radio network called Heritage Radio Network. That's another story, and that's a longer story. And he didn't have time for that. He and his now wife were doing a show called Urban Forager. They were just starting out. The innovator of that was Patrick Martins, who started Heritage Foods USA. They support small farmers and protecting heritage breeds and, you know, small producers selling to restaurants, chefs, and they have an online business. So Patrick Martins also brought slow food to the U.S. And he thought, well, maybe I'll do what the founder of Slow Food did. He started a radio station to drive more people to the website. So he started this little radio station in two shipping containers in the back of Roberta's Pizza Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And he got a few of his friends, people he sold meats to. He sold meats to my son for one of his restaurants and asked them, would they do some shows? And so he was doing a show and he said, Mom, I don't have time for this. He said, you're the one who should be doing a podcast. I said, you're right.
Wow. That's how it got started.
Yeah. Now, backing up a bit, not podcasting, but a radio show. After I left the Food Network, when it got wheels, several of us left. And several of us worked together on a website called Minute Meals, which spawned a couple of books as well. And an offshoot of Minute Meals, and again, trying to drive traffic to the website of Minute Meals, one of the guys working for it said, well, why don't we start a radio show? And he had some connection. It wasn't regular, it wasn't a podcast. It was a terrestrial radio show, but it was only in a few bizarre markets and, I don't know, all over the country. I was the executive producer. I got guests and topics, and there was one host, a good friend of mine, in her apartment in New York City with a hot seat, you know, to record from. There was another host who was in the studio where it was hosted from in Rhode Island, and then there was me doing it from my phone. So there were three of us communicating by phone and, get this, by fax.
Wow.
To
fax me
to put on a radio show every day for how long was it? Oh, it was long, an hour or 2 hours, called Everyday Kitchen. It was my very first guest that I booked was Julia Child.
Wow.
Yeah. And we had wonderful guests from the food world who just talk about, we actually gave recipes on the air and sort of like went through how to cook a meal on the air. And it was interesting. It was not something I would want to do again.
Tell me the origins of A Taste of the Past and like how that concept came to you in the early stages.
I had to think of a name. I sort of worked up a proposal when I knew Patrick Martins as well. And so I said, hey, I'm going to send you a proposal about a show. So I worked up an idea, which was, since culinary history was my passion, and there's really no outlet for culinary history, you know, then now there are more ways and there you can write books. And it was early on, 2009. So I wrote up a proposal, if you will, and said, oh, I got to come up with a name. So I was sitting around thinking, what would be a logical name? And A Taste of the Past came up, and it stuck, and it's been that ever since, almost 10 years now.
So for the audience listening in, give them an elevator pitch of your show.
A Taste of the Past is a look in, it's a culinary journey. It's a weekly journey through culinary history. We look at ancient history. We look at Rome and Mesopotamia, the beginnings of food. And we also look at where the hot dog came from. Tailgating? Yeah, what's the history of tailgating? You know, after 10 years of doing shows and so many shows, I have to look at the list myself.
All the time.
Right? Yeah. And Coney Island Hot Dog. I'm doing a recording of Coney Island Hot Dogs tomorrow, guys, resurrecting the Feltman's Coney Island Hot Dog.
Wow.
So I thought, wow, that's history worthy, you know? And then again, we'll talk about, what did the Roman soldiers eat? How did they support their armies? So there's it covers a lot of territory. Can't even pretend to know everything about each of those. I try to do a lot of research, in the week or two before, reading a lot of books, especially if the guest has a book, reading through the book. You want to sound like you know what you're talking about, and you have to have a good question to ask so you don't sound like you're coming totally out of left field. I can't play Larry King to them. We don't have enough time, too. We have to get right to the point. And it's been a wonderful experience. I have learned every week I learn something new.
I got a chance to listen to episode 337, the history of art and tailgating, which is the history of
the
art.
The history and the art.
Yeah, thank you. The history and the art. The history and the art of tailgating.
Is there an art to tailgating? Sure, there's an art to tailgating.
Tell me some things about the history of tailgating.
Oh, it was back in the late 1800s, the Yale, Harvard game. Well, actually, it wasn't Harvard-Yale first, but then it evolved into that, and they were the first ones to bring picnics. Of course, they brought picnics in horse-driven wagons,
Wasn't a Cadillac Escalade.
and a chuck wagon pulled up, and that's how a chuck wagon developed. It was a restaurant on wheels, it could ride up and you could have all the food in there and just, open the flap and start serving food from the wagon, just as people had their picnic baskets. And the other team, but they noticed people who came from out of town to watch the game, they got off the train, so they didn't have their picnic baskets. And they went over and they offered them some food from their picnic basket, which was kind of the start of the whole communal sharing. That's what tailgating's all about, so we learned. It's a lot of communal dining and sharing, and not just bringing your own separate meal and eating your own food, but you're kind of always looking next door to see, what are they serving? What are they eating? And you start up a conversation, you give them a little something of yours, they'll give you something back of theirs. And it's a real community type sharing meal. It's good.
Yeah, we're going to play a clip from episode 337.
All right. And this is Lynn Ryan, who was the guest. And she actually hopefully has a book forthcoming, Tailgate Buzz.
There we go. Let's go.
There is indeed a large consumption of alcohol these days on the parking lots, more so, I think, than in the past. They passed a law that they don't allow alcohol in the stadiums, most stadiums, the college stadiums.
Right. Most college stadiums do not have alcohol. Most, I believe most NFL stadiums do allow alcohol, but there are becoming more and more sober parties, especially at colleges.
There, right.
Each college has a group of people who do not drink for whatever reason, and they provide parties. And people are, more and more children are coming to tailgates. So a lot of people are choosing not to drink because it's not about, getting drunk and debauchery. It's more about enjoying yourself before you go into the game. Who
right.
wants to be drunk and right. spend all that money to go watch a game?
you know, I discovered your show, and one thing about the beautiful world of podcasting and doing this show, like, it's my job to discover new topics and new genres and new hosts and listen to new shows. And I came across your podcast from the Apple charts. It was like in the Apple top cooking or food charts. And I was like, hey, this seems really interesting. And I listened, I was like, oh man, I want to have her on the show. What does it feel like to have something that, as a creative, it's our job to take what the universe gives us in our head, to manifest it into something physical, to make it and send it out to the world. But the best feeling is having it be well received. How does it feel to have your show be so well received and so loved?
It never ceases to amaze me, because, you know, you do your podcasts, individually from your own location. I actually go into a studio to do the podcast, but no matter what, I sit there and I think, is anyone out there listening? So it always amazes me to, see any analytics and find out that people are actually listening to my podcast, or having them downloaded on, every week into their, whatever, their iPhones or, their smartphones. The other thing is, it's like, be careful what you wish for. I love it. And it's like a drug, and I can't quit it. And I guess I'll just keep on doing it.
All right, so Linda, we've come to a point in the show called our Podcaster's Picks. Mm-hmm. Now, this is when I ask today's special guests to give me their top three favorite podcasts that they love that we should be listening to. So, Linda, take it away.
Picking only three, Corey. That's,
I know.
Like,
I'm
saying,
sorry.
Who's your favorite child?
Sorry. I'm sorry.
I really enjoy listening to Sporkful with Dan Pashman. He interviews the greatest people. He tells the greatest stories. It's a lot about him telling the story, but then he goes out in the field and he gets interviews, or he doesn't, or one of somebody does, and gets interviews from the field. Really love it. I think it's really good. Another one I like a lot is Gravy from the Southern Foodways. And I think that squeezed out something else that I liked a lot. We will include Gastropod.
Tell me about Gastropod.
Gastropod is sort of like a combination of science and food, and they delve into it. It's Nicola Twilley and Cynthia Graber, and they kind of delve into the science and kind of some of the weird topics and background of food, and it's always entertaining. They really do a lot of work. They do a lot of research on their shows. Yeah. Highly edited.
And Linda, before we get out of here, why do you podcast?
Because I'm addicted? No. Because I love learning something new every time. Every time I always say, oh, that's it. I'm so tired. This took so much work. And then the next week, I go at it again because I need that input. I love learning from people. And I, as I said, I learn something every single week.
Linda, thank you so much for being here today on OPP. I really appreciate it. I'm a big fan of your show.
My pleasure.
And a big fan of what you do in the podcasting space. You're really dope.
My pleasure, Corey. Thank you.
We out of here. Thank you all so much for tuning in to another episode of OPP. And to our special guest, Linda Palacio. You can listen to A Taste of the Past on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. This episode was mixed by Joshua Coleman. Music for this episode was produced by Richie Quake. And are you down with OPP? If so, please be sure to leave us a 5-star rating in the Apple app and let me know your favorite podcast in the review section. Lastly, before we get out of here, check out my other show, Silent Giants, which highlights the superstars behind the scenes of popular culture. And you can find Silent Giants on Apple, Spotify, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Pop bless. Till next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.